Wine ships have passed through the Straits of Tarth and are moving swiftly up the coast. Only a few fishing boats remain on Dragonstone to oppose Redwine's landing. The castle may hold for some time, but once we have the port, we can cut the garrison off from the sea. Then only Stannis himself will remain to vex us. If Lord Janus can be believed, he is trying to make common cause with the wildlings, warned Grand Maester Pycelle. Savages in skins, declared Lord Merryweather. Lord Stannis must be desperate indeed to seek such allies. Desperate and foolish, the Queen agreed. The Northmen hate the wildlings. Roose Bolton should have no trouble winning them to our cause. A few have already joined up with his bastard son to help him clear the wretched Ironmen from Moat Cailin and clear the way for Lord Bolton to return. Umber, Risewell, I forget the other names. Even White Harbour is on the point of joining us. Its lord has agreed to marry both his granddaughters to our friends of Frey and open his port to our ships. I thought we had no ships, Sir Harry said, confused. Wyman Manderley was a loyal bannerman to Eddard Stark, said Grand Maester Pycelle. Can such a man be trusted? No one can be trusted. He's a fat old man and frightened. However, he is proving stubborn on one point. He insists that he will not bend the knee until his heir has been returned to him. Do we have this heir? Asked Sir Harry's. He will be at Harrenhal, if he is still alive. Gregor Clegane took him captive. The Mountain had not always been gentle with his prisoners, even those worth a goodly ransom. If he is dead, I suppose we will need to send Lord Manderley the heads of those who killed him, with our most sincere apologies. If one head was enough to appease a Prince of Dawn, a bag of them should be more than adequate for a fat Northman wrapped in sealskins. Will not Lord Stannis seek to win the allegiance of White Harbour as well? Asked Grand Maester Pycelle. Oh, he has tried. Lord Manderley has sent his letters on to us, and replied with evasions. Stannis demands White Harbour's swords and silver, for which he offers, well, nothing. One day she must light a candle to the stranger for carrying Renly off and leaving Stannis. If it had been the other way around, her life would have been harder. Just this morning there was another bird. Stannis has sent his onion smuggler to treat with White Harbour on his behalf. Manderley has clapped the wretch inside a cell. He asks us what he should do with him. Send him here. That we might question him, suggested Lord Merryweather. The man might know much of value. Let him die, said Caiban. His death will be a lesson to the North, to show them what becomes of traitors. I quite agree, the Queen said. I have instructed Lord Manderley to have his head off forthwith. That should put an end to any chance of White Harbour supporting Stannis. Stannis will need another hand, observed Aurane Waters with a chuckle. The Turnip Knight, perhaps? A Turnip Knight, said Sir Harry Swift, confused. Who is this man? I have not heard of him. Waters did not reply except to roll his eyes. What if Lord Manderley should refuse? Asked Merryweather. He dare not. The Onion Knight's head is the coin he'll need to buy his son's life, Circe smiled. The fat old fool may have been loyal to the Starks in his own way, but with the wolves of Winterfell extinguished. Your Grace has forgotten the Lady Sansa, said Pycelle. The Queen bristled. I most certainly have not forgotten that little she-wolf. She refused to say the girl's name. I ought to have shown her to the Black Cells as the daughter of a traitor, but instead I made her part of mine own household. She shared my hearth and hall, played with my own children. I fed her, dressed her, tried to make her a little less ignorant about the world. And how did she repay me for my kindness? She helped murder my son. When we find the imp, we will find the Lady Sansa, too. She is not dead, but before I am done with her, I promise you she will be singing to the stranger, begging for his kiss. An awkward silence followed. Have they all swallowed their tongues? Circe thought with irritation. It was enough to make her wonder why she bothered with a council. In any case, the Queen went on, Lord Eddard's younger daughter is with Lord Bolton and will be wed to his son Ramsay as soon as Moat Cailin has fallen. So long as the girl played her role well enough to cement their claim to Winterfell, neither of the Boltons would much care that she was actually some Stuart's whelp, tricked up by Littlefinger. If the North must have a Stark, we'll give them one. She let Lord Merryweather fill her cup once again. Another problem has arisen on the Wall, however. The brothers of the Night's Watch have taken leave of their wits and chosen Ned Stark's bastard son to be their Lord Commander. Snow, the boy is called, Pycelle said unhelpfully. I glimpsed him once at Winterfell, the Queen said, though the Starks did their best to hide him. He looks very like his father. Her husband's byblows had his look as well, though at least Robert had the grace to keep them out of sight. Once, after that sorry business with the cat, he had made some noises about bringing some base-born daughter of his to court. Do as you please, she'd told him, but you may find that the city is not a healthy place for a growing girl. The bruise those words had won her had been hard to hide from Jamie, but they heard no more about the bastard girl. Catelyn Tully was a mouse, or she would have smothered this Jon Snow in his cradle. Instead, she's left the filthy task to me. Snow shares Lord Eddard's taste for treason, too, she said. The father would have handed the realm to Stannis. The son has given him lands and castles. The Night's Watch is sworn to take no part in the wars of the Seven Kingdoms, Pycelle reminded them. For thousands of years the Black Brothers have upheld that tradition. Until now, said Cersei. The bastard boy has written us to a vow that the Night's Watch takes no side, but his actions give the lie to his words. He has given Stannis food and shelter, yet has the insolence to plead with us for arms and men. An outrage, declared Lord Merryweather. We cannot allow the Night's Watch to join its strength to that of Lord Stannis. We must declare this Snow a traitor and a rebel, agreed Sir Harry's Swift. The Black Brothers must remove him. Grand Maester Pycelle nodded ponderously. I propose that we inform Castle Black that no more men will be sent to them until such time as Snow is gone. Our new Drummonds will need oarsmen, said Aurane Waters. Let us instruct the lords to send their poachers and thieves to me henceforth instead of to the Wall. Kyburn leaned forward with a smile. The Night's Watch defends us all from Snarks and Grumpkins. My lords, I say that we must help the brave Black Brothers. Cersei gave him a sharp look. What are you saying? This, Kyburn said. For years now the Night's Watch has begged for men. Lord Stannis has answered their plea. Can King Tommen do less? His Grace should send the Wall 100 men to take the Black, ostensibly. But in truth, to remove Jon Snow from the command. Cersei finished, delighted. I knew I was right to want him on my council. That is just what we shall do, she laughed. If this bastard boy is truly his father's son, he will not suspect a thing. Perhaps he will even thank me before the blade slides between his ribs. It will need to be done carefully, to be sure. Leave the rest to me, my lords. This was how an enemy should be dealt with a dagger, not a declaration. We have done good work today, my lords. I thank you. Is there aught else? One last thing, your grace, said Aurane Waters in an apologetic tone. I hesitate to take up the council's time with trifles, but there has been some queer talk heard along the docks of late. Sailors from the east, they speak of dragons. And manticores, no doubt, and bearded snarks? Cersei chuckled. Come back to me when you hear talk of dwarfs, my lord. She stood to signal that the meeting was at an end. A blustery autumn wind was blowing when Cersei left the council chambers. and bells of Blessed Bela still sang their song of mourning off across the city. In the yard, 20 knights were hammering each other with sword and shield, adding to the din. Sir Boros Blount escorted the queen back to her apartments, where she found Lady Merryweather chuckling with Jocelyn and Dorcas. "What is it you all find so amusing?" "The Red Wine Twins," said Tana. "Both of them have fallen in love with Lady Margery. They used to fight over which would be the next Lord of the Arbor. Now both of them want to join the King's Guard just to be near the little queen." "The Red Wines have always had more freckles than wits. It was a useful thing to know, though, if Horror or Slobber were to be found abed with Margery." Circe wondered if the little queen liked freckles. "Dorcas, fetch me Sir Osney Kettleblack." Dorcas blushed. "As you command." When the girl was gone, Tana Merryweather gave the queen a quizzical look. Why did she turn so red? "Love." It was Circe's turn to laugh. "She fancies our Sir Osney." He was youngest Kettleblack, the clean-shaved one, though he had the same black hair, hooked nose, and easy smile as his brother Osmond. One cheek bore three long scratches, courtesy of one of Tyrion's whores. "She likes his scars, I think." Lady Merryweather's dark eyes shone with mischief. "Just so. Scars make a man look dangerous, and danger is exciting." "You shock me, my lady," the queen said, teasing. "If danger excites you so, why wed Lord Orton? We all love him, it is true, but still." Peter had once remarked that the horn of plenty that adorned House Merryweather's arms suited Lord Orton admirably, since he had carrot-coloured hair, a nose as bulbous as a beetroot, and peas porridge for wits. Tana laughed. "My lord is more bountiful than dangerous, this is so. Yet, I hope your grace will not think the less of me, but I did not come a maid entire to Orton's bed." "You are all whores in the free cities, aren't you?" That was good to know. One day she might be able to make use of it. "And pray, who was this lover who was so full of danger?" Tana's olive skin turned even darker as she blushed. "Oh, I should not have spoken. Your grace will keep my secret, yes? Men have scars, women mysteries." Circe kissed her cheek. "I will have his name out of you soon enough." When Dorcas returned with Sir Osney Kettleblack, the queen dismissed her ladies. "Come, sit with me by the window, Sir Osney. Will you take a cup of wine?" She poured for them herself. "Your cloak is threadbare. I have a mind to put you in a new one." "What? A white one? Who's died?" "No one, as yet," the queen said. "Is that your wish, to join your brother Osmond in our King's Guard?" "I'd rather be the Queen's Guard, if it please your grace." When Osney grinned, the scars on his cheek turned bright red. Circe's fingers traced their path across his cheek. "You have a bold tongue, sir. You will make me forget myself again." "Good." Sir Osney caught her hand and kissed her fingers roughly. "My sweet queen." "You are a wicked man," the queen whispered, "and no true knight, I think." She let him touch her breasts through the silk of her gown. "Enough." "It isn't. I want you." "You've had me. Only once." He grabbed her left breast again and gave it a clumsy squeeze that reminded her of Robert. "One good night for one good night. You did me valiant service, and you had your reward." Circe walked her fingers up his laces. She could feel him stiffening through his breeches. "Was that a new horse you were riding in the yard yestermorn?" "The black stallion, aye, a gift from my brother Osfrid. Midnight, I call him." "How wonderfully original." "A fine mount for a battle. For pleasure, though, there is nothing to compare to a gallop on a spirited young filly." She gave him a smile and a squeeze. "Tell me true. Do you think our little queen is pretty?" Sir Osney drew back, wary. "I suppose, for a girl, I'd sooner have a woman. Why not both? She whispered. Pluck the little rose for me, and you will not find me to be ungrateful. The little... Marjorie, you mean? Sir Osney's ardour was wilting in his breeches. She's the king's wife. Wasn't there some king's guard who lost his head for bedding the king's wife? Ages ago, she was his king's mistress, not his wife, and his head was the only thing he did not lose. Aegon dismembered him piece by piece and made the woman watch. Circe did not want Osney dwelling on that ancient unpleasantness, however. Tommen is not Aegon the Unworthy. Have no fear, he will do as I bid him. I mean for Marjorie to lose her head, not you. That gave him pause. Her maidenhead, you mean? That, too, assuming she still has one. She traced his scars again. Unless you think Marjorie would prove unresponsive to your charms. Osney gave her a wounded look. She likes me well enough. Them cousins of hers are always teasing with me about my nose, how big it is and all. The last time Mega did that, Marjorie told them to stop and said I had a lovely face. There you are, then. There I am, the man agreed in a doubtful tone. But where am I going to be after we do the deed? Circe gave him a barbed smile. Lying with a queen is treason. Tommen would have no choice but to send you to the wall. The wall, he said with dismay. It was all she could do not to laugh. No, best not. Men hate being laughed at. A black cloak would go well with your eyes and that black hair of yours. No one returns from the wall. You will. All you need do is kill a boy. What boy? A bastard boy in league with Stannis. He's young and green, and you'll have 100 men. Kettle Black was afraid. She could smell it on him, but he was too proud to own up to that fear. Men are all alike. I've killed more boys than I can count, he insisted. Once this boy is dead, I'd get my pardon from the king. That and a lordship, unless Snow's brothers hang you first. A queen must have a consort, one who knows no fear. Lord Kettle Black? A slow smile spread across his face and his scars flamed red. Aye, I like the sound of that. A lordly lord. And fit to bed a queen, he frowned. The wall is cold, and I am warm. Circe put her arms about his neck. Bed a girl and kill a boy, and I am yours. Do you have the courage? Osney thought a moment before he nodded. I am your man. You are, sir. She kissed him and let him have a little taste of tongue before she broke away. Enough for now. The rest must wait. Will you dream of me tonight? Aye. His voice was hoarse. And when you're abed with our maid Marjorie, she asked him, teasing, when you're in her, will you dream of me then? I will, swore Osney Kettle Black. Good. After he was gone, Circe summoned Jocelyn to brush her hair out, whilst she slipped off her shoes and stretched like a cat. I was made for this, she told herself. It was the sheer elegance of it that pleased her most. Even Mace Tyrell would not dare defend his darling daughter if she was caught in the act with the likes of Osney Kettleblack, and neither Stannis Baratheon nor Jon Snow would have cause to wonder why Osney was being sent to the wall. She would see to it that Sir Osmond was the one to discover his brother with the little queen. That way the loyalty of the other two Kettleblacks need not be impugned. If father could only see me now, he would not be so quick to speak of marrying me off again. A pity he's so dead, him and Robert, John Arryn, Ned Stark, Renly Baratheon, all dead. Only Tyrion remains, and not for long. That night the queen summoned Lady Merryweather to her bedchamber. Will you take a cup of wine? She asked her. A small one. The Meerish woman laughed. A big one. On the morrow, I want you to pay a call on my good daughter, Circe said as Dorcas was dressing her for bed. Lady Marjorie is always happy to see me. I know. The queen did not fail to note the style that Tena used when referring to Tommen's little wife. Tell her I've sent 7 beeswax candles to the Baylor's Sept in memory of our dear High Septon. Tena laughed. If so, she will send 77 candles of her own so as not to be outmourned. I will be very cross if she does not, the queen said, smiling. Tell her also that she has a secret admirer, a knight so smitten with her beauty that he cannot sleep at night. Might I ask your grace which knight? Mischief sparkled in Tena's big dark eyes. Could it be Sir Osney? It could be, the queen said, but do not offer up that name freely. Make her worm it out of you. Will you do that? If it please you, that is all I wish, your grace. Outside, a cold wind was rising. They stayed up late into the morning, drinking Arbor Gold and telling one another tales. Tena got quite drunk, and Circe pried the name of her secret lover from her. He was a Mirish sea captain, half a pirate, with black hair to the shoulders and a scar that ran across his face from chin to ear. 100 times I told him no, and he said yes, the other woman told her, until finally I was saying yes as well. He was not the sort of man to be denied. I know the sort, the queen said with a wry smile. Has your grace ever known a man like that, I wonder? Roberts, she lied, thinking of Jamie. Yet when she closed her eyes, it was the other brother that she dreamt of, and the 3 wretched fools with whom she had begun her day. In the dream it was Tyrion's head they brought her in their sack. She had it bronzed and kept it in her chamber pot.
John. Careful of the rats, my lord, Dolores Ed led John down the steps, a lantern in one hand. They make an awful squeal if you step on them. My mother used to make a similar sound when I was a boy. She must have had some rat in her, now that I think of it. Brown hair, beady little eyes, like cheese. Might be she had a tail too, I never looked to see. All of Castle Black was connected underground by a maze of tunnels that the brothers called the Wormways. It was dark and gloomy underneath the earth, so the Wormways were little used in summer. But when the winter winds began to blow and the snows began to fall, the tunnels became the quickest way to move about the castle. The Stuarts were making use of them already. John saw candles burning in several wall niches as they made their way along the tunnel, their footsteps echoing ahead of them. Bone Marsh was waiting at a junction where 4 Wormways met. With him he had Wick Whittlestick, tall and skinny as a spear. These are the counts from 3 turns ago, Marsh told John, offering him a thick sheaf of papers. For comparison with our present stores, shall we start with the granaries? They moved through the grey gloom beneath the earth. Each storeroom had a solid oaken door closed with an iron padlock, as big as a supper plate. Is pilferage a problem? John asked. Not as yet, said Bowen Marsh. Once winter comes, though, your lordship might be wise to post guards down here. Wick Whittlestick wore the keys on a ring about his neck. They all looked alike to John, yet somehow Wick found the right one for every door. Once inside, he would take a fist-sized chunk of chalk from his pouch and mark each cask and sack and barrel as he counted them, while Marsh compared the new count to the old. In the granaries were oats and wheat and barley, and barrels of coarse ground flour. In the root cellars, strings of onions and garlic dangled from the rafters, and bags of carrots, parsnips, radishes, and white and yellow turnips filled the shelves. One storeroom held wheels of cheese so large it took 2 men to move them. In the next, casks of salt beef, salt pork, salt mutton, and salt cod were stacked 10 feet high. 300 hams and 3,000 long black sausages hung from ceiling beams below the smokehouse. In the spice locker they found peppercorns, cloves, and cinnamon, mustard seeds, coriander, sage and clary sage, and parsley, blocks of salt. Elsewhere were casks of apples and pears, dried peas, dried figs, bags of walnuts, bags of chestnuts, bags of almonds, planks of dry smoked salmon, clay jars packed with olives and oil and sealed with wax. One storeroom offered potted hare, haunch of deer in honey, pickled cabbage, pickled beets, pickled onions, pickled eggs, and pickled herring. As they moved from one vault to another, the worm ways seemed to grow colder. Before long, John could see their breath frosting in the lantern light. "We're beneath the wall."
"And soon inside it," said Marsh. "The meat won't spoil in the cold. For long storage, it's better than salting."
The next door was made of rusty iron. Behind it was a flight of wooden steps. Dolorous Ed led the way with his lantern. Up top they found a tunnel as long as Winterfell's great hall, though no wider than the wormways. The walls were ice, bristling with iron hooks. From each hook hung a carcass, skinned deer and elk, sides of beef, huge sows swinging from the ceiling, headless sheep and goats, even horse and bear. Hoarfrost covered everything. As they did their count, John peeled the glove off his left hand and touched the nearest haunch of venison. He could feel his fingers sticking, and when he pulled them back, he lost a bit of skin. His fingertips were numb. "What did you expect? There's a mountain of ice above your head. More tons than even Bowen Marsh could count." Even so, the room felt colder than it should.
"It is worse than I feared, my lord," Marsh announced when he was done. He sounded gloomier than Dolorous Ed.
John had just been thinking that all the meat in the world surrounded them. "You know nothing, Jon Snow."
"How so?
This seems a deal of food to me."
"It was a long summer. The harvests were bountiful, the lords generous. We had enough laid by to see us through 3 years of winter, four with a bit of scrimping. Now, though, if we must go on feeding all these kingsmen and queensmen and wildlings, Molestown alone has 1,000 useless mouths, and still they come. Three more turned up yesterday at the gates, a dozen the day before. It cannot go on. Settling them on the gift, that's well and good, but it's too late to plant crops. We'll be down to turnips and peas porridge before the year is out. After that, we'll be drinking the blood of our own horses."
"Yum," declared Dolorhead. "Nothing beats a hot cup of horse blood on a cold night. I like mine with a pinch of cinnamon sprinkled on top."
The Lord Steward paid him no mind.
"There will be sickness too," he went on. "Bleeding gums and loose teeth. Maester Aemon used to say that lime juice and fresh meat would remedy that. But our limes were gone a year ago, and we do not have enough fodder to keep herds afoot for fresh meat. We should butcher all but a few breeding pairs. It's past time. In winters past, food could be brought up the King's Road from the south. But with the war...
It is still autumn, I know, but I would advise we go on winter rations nonetheless, if it please my lord."
"Oh, the men will love that."
"If we must, we'll cut each man's portion by a quarter."
"If my brothers are complaining of me now, what will they say when they're eating snow and acorn paste?"
"That will help, my lord."
The Lord Steward's tone made it plain that he did not think that it would help enough.
Dolorous Ed said, "Now I understand why King Stannis led the wildlings through the war. He means for us to eat them."
John had to smile. "It will not come to that."
"Oh, good," said Ed. "They look a stringy lot, and my teeth are not as sharp as when I was younger."
"If we had sufficient coin, we could buy food from the south and bring it in by ship," the Lord Steward said.
"We could," thought John, "if we had the gold and someone willing to sell us food." Both of those were lacking.
Our best hope may be the Eyrie. The Vale of Arryn was famously fertile and had gone untouched during the fighting. John wondered how Lady Caitlin's sister would feel about feeding Ned Stark's bastard. As a boy, he often felt as if the lady grudged him every bite.
"We can always hunt if need be," Wick Whittlestick put in. "There's still game in the woods."
"And wildlings and darker things," said Marsh.
"I would not send out hunters, my lord, I would not."
"No, you would close our gates forever and seal them up with stone and ice." Half of Castle Black agreed with the Lord Steward's views, he knew. The other half heaped scorn on them.
"Seal our gates and plant your fat black arses on the wall. Aye, and the free folk will come swarming over the Bridge of Skulls or through some gate you thought you'd sealed 500 years ago."
The old forester Dywin had declared loudly over supper two nights past.
"We don't have the men to watch 100 leagues of wall. Tormund Giantspot and the Bloody Weeper know it too. Ever see a duck frozen in a pond with his feet in the ice? It works the same for crows."
Most rangers echoed Dywin, whilst the stewards and builders inclined toward Bowen Marsh. But that was a quandary for another day. Here and now the problem was food. "We cannot leave King Stannis and his men to starve, even if we wish to," John said. "If need be, he could simply take all this at sword point. We do not have the men to stop them. The wildlings must be fed as well."
"How, my lord?" asked Bowen Marsh.
"Would that I knew. We will find a way." By the time they returned to the surface, the shadows of the afternoon were growing long. Clouds streaked the sky like tattered banners, grey and white and torn. The yard outside the armory was empty, but inside John found the king's squire awaiting him. Devon was a skinny lad of some 12 years, brown of hair and eye. They found him frozen by the forge, hardly daring to move as ghosts sniffed him up and down. "He won't hurt you," John said, but the boy flinched at the sound of his voice, and that sudden motion made the direwolf bare his teeth.
"No," John said. "Ghost, leave him be. Away."
The wolf slunk back to his oxbone, silence on 4 feet. Devon looked as pale as ghost, his face damp with perspiration.
My lord, his grace commands your presence."
The boy was clad in Baratheon gold and black, with the flaming heart of a queen's man sewn above his own.
"You mean requests," said Dolorous Ed. "His grace requests the presence of the Lord Commander. That's how I'd say it."
"Leave it be, Ed." John was in no mood for such squabbles.
"Sir Richard and Sir Justin have returned," said Devon. "Will you come, my lord?"
"Ah, the wrong way rangers." Massienhorpe had ridden south, not north. Whatever they had learned did not concern the night's watch, but John was curious all the same. If it would please his grace, he followed the young squire back across the yard. Ghosts padded after them until John said, "No, stay." Instead, the direwolf ran off. In the King's Tower, John was stripped of his weapons and admitted to the royal presence. The solar was hot and crowded. Stannis and his captains were gathered over the map of the north. The Wrongway Rangers were amongst them. Sigorn was there as well, the young Magna of Thenn, clad in a leather hauberk sewn with bronze scales. Rattleshirt sat scratching at the manacle on his wrist with a cracked yellow fingernail. Brown stubble covered his sunken cheeks and receding chin, and strands of dirty hair hung across his eyes.
"Here he comes," he said when he saw John, "the brave boy who slew Mance Rayder when he was caged and bound."
The big square-cut gem that adorned his iron cuff glimmered redly.
"Do you like my ruby, Snow? A token of love from Lady Red."
John ignored him and took a knee.
"Your Grace," announced the Squire Devon, "I've brought Lord Snow."
"I can see that. Lord Commander, you know my knights and captains, I believe."
"I have that honour."
He made it a point to learn all he could of the men around the king. Queen's men all. It struck John as odd that there were no king's men about the king, but that seemed to be the way of it. The king's men had incurred Stannis' ire on Dragonstone, if the talk John heard was true.
There is wine, or water boiled with lemons.
Thank you, but no.
As you wish. I have a gift for you, Lord Snow.
The king waved a hand at Rattleshirt.
Him.
Lady Melisandre smiled.
You did say you wanted men, Lord Snow. I believe our Lord of Bones still qualifies.
John was aghast. Your Grace, this man cannot be trusted. If I keep him here, someone will slit his throat for him. If I send him ranging, he'll just go back over to the wildlings.
Not me. I've done with those bloody fools.
Rattleshirt tapped the ruby on his wrist.
Ask your red witch, bastard.
Melisandre spoke softly in a strange tongue. The ruby at her throat throbbed slowly, and John saw that the smaller stone on Rattleshirt's wrist was brightening and darkening as well. So long as he wears the gem, he is bound to me, blood and soul, the Red Priestess said. This man will serve you faithfully. The flames do not lie, Lord Snow. Perhaps not, John thought. But you do.
I'll range for you, bastard, Rattleshirt declared. I'll give you sage counsel, or sing you pretty songs, as you prefer. I'll even fight for you. Just don't ask me to wear your cloak.
You're not worthy one, John thought, but he held his tongue. No good would come of squabbling before the king. King Stannis said,
Lord Snow, tell me of Mors Umber.
The Night's Watch takes no part, John thought. But another voice within him said, words are not swords. The elder of the great John's uncles, Crowfood they call him, a crow once took him for dead and pecked out his eye. He caught the bird in his fist and bit its head off. When Mors was young, he was a fearsome fighter. His sons died on the Trident, his wife in childbed. His only daughter was carried off by wildlings 30 years ago. That's why he wants the head, said Harwood Fell.
Can this man Mors be trusted? Asked Stannis.
Has Mors Umber bent the knee? Your Grace should have him swear an oath before his heart tree. Godry, the giant slayer, guffawed.
I had forgotten that you Northmen worship trees.
What sort of god lets himself be pissed upon by dogs? Asked Faring's crony, Clayton Suggs.
John chose to ignore them. Your Grace, might I know if the Umbers have declared for you?
Half of them, and only if I meet this Crowfood's price, said Stannis, in an irritated tone. He wants Mance Rayder's skull for a drinking cup, and he wants a pardon for his brother, who has ridden south to join Bolton. Horsebane, he's called.
Sir Godfrey was amused by that as well.
What names is Northman have? Did this one bite the head off some more?
John regarded him coolly. You might say so. A whore who tried to rob him 50 years ago in Old Town. Odd as it might seem, old Hoarfrost Umber had once believed his youngest son had the makings of a maester. Mors loved to boast about the crow who took his eye. But Hother's tale was only told in whispers, most like because the whore he disemboweled had been a man. Have other lords declared for Bolton too? The Red Priestess slid closer to the king.
I saw a town with wooden walls and wooden streets, filled with men. Banners flew above its walls. A moose, a battle axe, 3 pine trees, long axes crossed beneath a crown. A horse's head with fiery eyes.
Ornwood, Serwin, Tallheart,
Risewell, and Dustin, supplied Sir Clayton Suggs. Traitors all, lapdogs of the Lannisters. The Risewells and Dustins are tied to House Bolton by marriage, John informed him. Those others have lost their lords in the fighting. I do not know who leads them now. Crow Food is no lapdog, though. Your Grace would do well to accept his terms. Stannis ground his teeth. He informs me that Umber will not fight Umber for any cause. John was not surprised. If it comes to swords, see where Hother's banner flies, and put Moore's on the other end of the line. The giant slayer disagreed.
You would make his grace look weak. I say, show our strength. Burn Last Hearth to the ground and ride to war with Crow Food's head mounted on a spear as a lesson to the next lord who presumes to offer half his homage.
A fine plan, if what you want is every hand in the north raised against you. Half is more than none. The Umbers have no love for the Boltons. If Horsbane has joined the bastard, it can only be because the Lannisters hold the great John captive. That is his pretext, not his reason, declared Sir Godfrey. If the nephew dies in chains, these uncles can claim his lands and lordship for themselves. The great John has sons and daughters both. In the north, the children of a man's body still come before his uncle, sir. Unless they die. Dead children come last everywhere. Suggest that in the hearing of Moore's Umber, Sir Godfrey, and you will learn more of death than you might wish.
I have slain a giant boy. Why should I fear some flea-ridden Northman who paints one on his shield?
The giant was running away. Moore's won't be. The big knight flushed.
You have a bold tongue in the king's solar, boy. In the yard you sang a different song.
Oh, leave off, Godfrey, said Sir Justin Massey, a loose-limbed, fleshy knight with a ready smile and a mop of flaxen hair. Massey had been one of the Rungway Rangers. We all know what a big giant sword you have, I'm sure. No need for you to wave it in our faces yet again.
The only thing waving here is your tongue, Massey. Be quiet, Stannis snapped. Lord Snow, attend me. I have lingered here in the hopes that the wildlings would be fool enough to mount another attack upon the wall. As they will not oblige me, it is time I dealt with my other foes.
I see. John's tone was wary.
What does he want of me?
I have no love for Lord Bolton or his son, but the Night's Watch cannot take up arms against them. Our vows prohibit...
I know all about your vows. Spare me your rectitude, Lord Snow. I have strength enough without you. I have a mind to march against the Dreadfort.
When he saw the shock on John's face, he smiled.
Does that surprise you? Good. What surprises one Snow may yet surprise another. The bastard of Bolton has gone south, taking Hother Umber with him. On that, Moore's Umber and Arnulf Carstock are agreed. That can only mean a strike at Moat Cailin, to open the way for his lord father to return to the north. The bastard must think I'm too busy with the wildlings to trouble him. Well and good. The boy has shown me his throat. I mean to rip it out. Roose Bolton may regain the north, but when he does, he will find his castle, herds and harvest all belong to me. If I take the Dreadfort unawares,
you won't, John blurted. It was as if he whacked a wasp's nest with a stick. One of the Queen's men laughed, one spat, one muttered a curse, and the rest all tried to talk at once.
The boy has milk water in his veins, said Sir Godfrey the Giant Slayer,
and Lord Sweet huffed. The craven sees an outlaw behind every blade of grass. Stannis raised a hand for silence.
Explain your meaning.
Where to begin? John moved to the map. Candles had been placed at its corners to keep the hide from rolling up. A finger of warm wax, slow as a glacier, was puddling out across the Bay of Seals. To reach the Dreadfort, your Grace must travel down the King's Road, past the last river, turn south by east, and cross the lonely hills. He pointed. Those are Umberlands. where they know every tree and every rock. The King's Road runs along their western marches for 100 leagues. Moors will cut your host to pieces unless you meet his terms and win him to your cause.
Very well. Let us say I do that.
That will bring you to the Dreadfort, said John. But unless your host can outmarch a raven or a line of beacon fires, the castle will know of your approach. It will be an easy thing for Ramsay Bolton to cut off your retreat and leave you far from the wall without food or refuge, surrounded by your foes.
Only if he abandons his siege of Moat Cailin.
Moat Cailin will fall before you ever reach the Dreadfort. Once Lord Roos has joined his strength to Ramsay's, they will have you outnumbered 5-1. My brother won battles at worse odds.
You assume Moat Cailin will fall quickly, Snow, objected Justin Massey. But the Arnmen are doughty fighters, and I have heard it said that the moat has never been taken.
From the south. A small garrison in Moat Cailin can play havoc with any army coming up the causeway, but the ruins are vulnerable from the north and east. John turned back to Stannis. Sire, this is a bold stroke, but the risk... The Night's Watch takes no part. Baratheon or Bolton should be the same to me. If Roose Bolton should catch you beneath his walls with his main strength, it will be the end for all of you.
Risk is part of war, declared Sir Richard Hope, a lean knight with a ravaged face, whose quilted doublet showed 3 death's-head moths on a field of ash and bone. Every battle is a gamble, Snow. The man who does nothing also takes a risk.
There are risks and risks, Sir Richard. This one, it is too much, too soon, too far away. I know the Dreadfort. It is a strong castle, all of stone with thick walls and massive towers. With winter coming, you will find it well provisioned. Centuries ago, House Bolton rose up against the king in the north, and Harlan Stark laid siege to the Dreadfort. It took him 2 years to starve them out. To have any hope of taking the castle, your grace would need siege engines, towers, battering rams.
Siege towers can be raised, if need be, Stannis said. Trees can be felled for rams, if rams are required. Arn of Carstock writes that fewer than 50 men remain at the Dreadfort, half of them servants. A strong castle, weakly held, is weak.
50 men inside a castle are worth 500 outside.
That depends upon the men, said Richard Hawke. These will be grey beards and green boys, the men this bastard did not deem fit for battle.
Our own men were blooded and tested on the Blackwater, and they are led by knights.
You saw how we went through the wildlings,
Sir Justin pushed back a lock of flaxen hair.
The Carstocks have sworn to join us at the Dreadfort, and we will have our wildlings as well, 300 men of fighting age. Lord Harwood made a count as they were passing through the gate. Their women fight as well.
Stannis gave him a sour look.
Not for me, sir. I want no widows wailing in my wake. The women will remain here, with the old, the wounded, and the children. They will serve as hostages for the loyalty of their husbands and fathers. The wildling men will form my van. The Magnar will command them with their own chiefs as sergeants. First, though, we must needs arm them.
He means to plunder our armory, John realized. Food and clothing, land and castles, now weapons. He draws me in deeper every day. Words might not be swords, but swords were swords.
I could find 300 spears, he said, reluctantly. Helms as well, if you take them old and dinted and red with rust.
Armor, asked the Magna. Plate. Mail.
When Donal Noy died, we lost our armor. The rest John left unspoken.
Give the wildlings mail, and there'll be twice as great a danger to the realm.
"Boiled leather will suffice," said Sir Godfrey. "Once we've tasted battle, survivors can loot the dead."
"The few who live that long? If Stannis placed the free folk in the van, most would perish quickly. Drinking from Mance Rayder's skull may give Mors Umber pleasure, but seeing wildlings cross his lands will not. The free folk have been raiding the Umbers since the dawn of days, crossing the Bay of Seals for gold and sheep and women. One of those carried off was Crowfood's daughter. Your Grace, leave the wildlings here. Taking them will only serve to turn my lord father's bannerman against you. Your father's bannerman seem to have no liking for my cause in any case. I must assume they see me as, what was it that you call me, Lord Snow? Another doomed pretender?
Stannis stared at the map. For a long moment the only sound was the king grinding his teeth.
Leave me, all of you. Lord Snow, remain.
The brusque dismissal did not sit well with Justin Massey, but he had no choice but to smile and withdraw. Hawp followed him out, after giving John a measured look. Clayton Suggs drained his cup dry and muttered something to Harwood Fell that made the younger man laugh. Boy was part of it. Suggs was an up-jumped hedge knight, as crude as he was strong. The last man to take his leave was Rattleshirt. At the door he gave John a mocking bow, grinning through a mouthful of brown and broken teeth. All of you did not seem to include Lady Melisandre, the king's red shadow. Stannis called to Devon for more lemon water. When his cup was filled, the king drank and said,
"Hope and Massey aspire to your father's seat. Massey wants a wildling princess, too. He once served my brother Robert as squire, and acquired his appetite for female flesh. Hope will take Val to wife if I command it, but it is battle he lusts for. As a squire he dreamed of a white cloak, but Cersei Lannister spoke against him, and Robert passed him over, perhaps rightly. Sir Richard is too fond of killing. Which would you have as Lord of Winterfell, Snow? The Smiler or the Slayer?"
John said, "Winterfell belongs to my sister, Sansa."
"I've heard all I need to hear of Lady Lannister and her claim."
The king set the cup aside.
"You could bring the North to me. Your father's bannerman would rally to the son of Eddard Stark, even Lord Too Fat to Sit a Horse. White Harbour would give me a ready source of supply, and a secure base to which I could retreat at need. It is not too late to amend your folly, Snow. Take a knee and swear that bastard sword to me, and rise as John Stark, Lord of Winterfell and Warden of the North."
How many times will he make me say it? "My sword is sworn to the Night's Watch."
Stannis looked disgusted. "Your father was a stubborn man as well. Honour, he called it. Well, honour has its costs, as Lord Eddard learned to his sorrow. If it gives you any solace, Hope and Massey are doomed to disappointment. I am more inclined to bestow Winterfell upon Arnulf Karstark, a good Northman."
A Northman. Better a Karstark than a Bolton or a Greyjoy, John told himself, but the thought gave him little solace. The Karstarks abandoned my brother amongst his enemies.
"After your brother took off Lord Rickard's head, Arnulf was 1,000 leagues away. He has Stark blood in him, the blood of Winterfell.
No more than half the other houses of the North.
Those other houses have not declared for me. Arnulf Karstark is an old man with a crooked back, and even in his youth he was never the fighter Lord Rickard was. The rigors of the campaign may well kill him."
"He has heirs," Stannis snapped. 2 sons, 6 grandsons, some daughters. If Robert had fathered true-born sons, many who are dead might still be living."
"Your Grace would do better with Mors Crowfood."
"The Dreadfort will be the proof of that."
Then you mean to go ahead with this attack?
Despite the counsel of the great Lord Snow, I. Hawp and Massey may be ambitious, but they are not wrong. I dare not sit idle whilst Roose Bolton's star waxes and mine wanes. I must strike and show the North that I am still a man to fear.
The Merman of Manderley was not amongst those banners Lady Melisandre saw in her fires, John said. If you had White Harbour and Lord Wyman's knights,
if is a word for fools. We have had no word from Davos. It may be he never reached White Harbour. Arnulf Karstark writes that the storms have been fierce upon the narrow sea. Be that as it may, I have no time to grieve, nor wait upon the whims of Lord Too Fat. I must consider White Harbour lost to me. Without a son of Winterfell to stand beside me, I can only hope to win the North by battle. That requires stealing a leaf from my brother's book. Not that Robert ever read one. I must deal my foes a mortal blow before they know that I am on them.
John realized that his words were wasted. Stannis would take the dread fort or die in the attempt. The Night's Watch takes no part, a voice said, but another replied, Stannis fights for the realm, the Iron Men for thralls and plunder. Your Grace, I know where you might find more men. Give me the wildlings, and I will gladly tell you where and how.
I gave you Rattleshirt. Be content with him.
I want them all. Some of your own sworn brothers would have me believe that you are half a wildling yourself. Is it true? To you they are only arrow fodder. I can make better use of them upon the wall. Give them to me to do with as I will, and I'll show you where to find your victory, and men as well. Stannis rubbed the back of his neck. You haggle like a crone with a codfish, Lord Snow. Did Ned Stark father you on some fishwife? How many men?
2,000, perhaps 3.
3,000? What manner of men are these?
Proud, poor, prickly where their honour is concerned, but fierce fighters.
This had best not be some bastard's trick. Will I trade 300 fighters for 3,000? Aye, I will. I am not an utter fool. If I leave the girl with you as well, do I have your word that you will keep our princess closely?
She's not a princess.
As you wish, Your Grace. Do I need to make you swear an oath before a tree?
No. Was that a jape? With Stannis it was hard to tell.
Done, then. Now, where are these men?
You'll find them here. John spread his burned hand across the map, west of the King's Road and south of the Gift.
Those mountains?
Stannis grew suspicious.
I see no castles marked there, no roads, no towns, no villages.
The map is not the land, my father often said. Men have lived in the high valleys and mountain meadows for thousands of years, ruled by their clan chiefs. Petty lords, you would call them, though they do not use such titles amongst themselves. Clan champions fight with huge two-handed greatswords, while the common men sling stones and batter one another with staffs of mountain ash. A quarrelsome folk, it must be said. When they are not fighting one another, they tend their herds, fish the Bay of Ice, and breed the hardiest mounts you'll ever ride.
And they will fight for me, you believe? If you ask them, why should I beg for what is owed me?
Ask, I said, not beg. John pulled back his hand. It is no good sending messages. Your Grace will need to go to them yourself, eat their bread and salt, drink their ale, listen to their pipers, praise the beauty of their daughters and the courage of their sons, and you'll have their swords. The clans had not seen a king since Torrhen Stark bent his knee. Your coming does them honour. Command them to fight for you, and they will look at one another and say, who is this man? He is no king of mine.
How many clans are you speaking of?
2 score,
small and large, Flint, Wall, Norrie, Liddell. Win old Flint and Big Bucket. The rest will follow. Big Bucket. The Wall, he has the biggest belly in the mountains and the most men.